Hello everyone, welcome to the Scientific Sense podcast, where we explore emerging ideas from science, policy, economics, and technology. My name is Gil Epen. We talk with world's leading academics and experts about their recent research or general areas of topical interest. Scientific Sense is an unstructured conversation with no agenda or preparation. We cover a wide variety of domains where new discoveries are made and new technologies are developed on a daily basis. We are most interested in how ideas affect society and help educate the world how to pursue a rewarding and enjoyable life rooted in science, logic, and information. We seek knowledge without boundaries and constraints and provide unedited content of conversations with researchers and leaders who love what they do. A companion blog to this podcast can be found at scientificsense.com. And this podcast is available on over a dozen platforms and directly at scientificsense.net. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, and other ideas, please send them to info@scientificsense.com. And I can be reached at gil@epen.info. Before we start, I want to mention that I was recently introduced to a company, Magic Mind, who sent me samples of their product that boosts energy and focus. The ingredients are all natural, including organic matcha green tea, lion's mane mushrooms, cordyceps, choline, ashwagandha, turmeric, and vitamin C and D. The product is well formulated and nicely packaged. A small bottle for a single dose that can be consumed in a few seconds. I found the product very useful to keep me focused, reduce stress, elevate mood, enhance cognition, and generally keep a healthy immune system. I found it particularly useful when I'm tired. There are no controlled clinical trials yet, but the company is working on it so that consumers can have excellent scientific data as well. I would recommend you try it and let the company know of your feedback. They love to hear from their customers. The product is called Magic Mind and is available in most online retail stores. You get 1 month for free when you're subscribing for 3 months at www.magicmind.com/JanScientificSense. That is J-A-N Scientific Sense. And with the code EAPEN20, E-A-P-E-N 20. It's an extra 20% off, which gets you a total of 75% off. This only lasts until the end of January. So I would strongly recommend you try. My guest today is Professor James Robinson, who is Professor of Global Conflict Studies and University Professor at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. His work explores the underlying causes of economic and political divergence, both historically and today, and uses both the mathematical and quantitative methods of economics, along with the case study, qualitative, and fieldwork methodologies used in other social sciences. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
Yeah, so thanks for doing this. So we want to focus on one of your books. I know that you have written several. The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty, Why Nations Fail. I found the book really fascinating, James. So to set the context for the general public, I had an appetizer, a short appetizer at University of Chicago in the 90s. And I knew the five-course meal that followed would have been exceptionally great, but I didn't stay for the meal. And so both of us, in some sense, have a little bit of a bias, the Chicago school bias. And so I think, what we talk about is, might be in that context. So let me ask you upfront, what is the book about?
Well, the book proposes a way to think about, you know, poverty and prosperity in the world. You know, why is the distribution, why does the distribution of income in, and prosperity in the world look the way it does? And what's the difference between poor countries and rich countries? And how did they get that way? Looking kind of more historically, you know, where, how did this divergence take place in the world? That's what it's about.
So prosperity divergence. So I want to sort of go through the book. So to set the context, in the preface, you say here why Egyptians filled Tahrir Square to bring down Hosni Mubarak, and what it means for our understanding of the causes of prosperity and poverty. So Egypt is a long case study. A lot of things have happened there. And I don't know if you talk about this in the book, James, about the Arab Spring related issues. So what do you mean? What do you mean here?
Yeah, I mean that's trying to set the scene, you know, looking at the Arab Spring, and I think that's particularly important for us because, you know, we're sort of trying to think about, why is Egypt poor, and you know, we say Egypt is poor because it has what we call extractive economic institutions. You know, it has, the economy is organized in ways which benefit a few at the expense of the majority of people. Okay, so the basic story in the book about, you know, what's the difference between poor countries and rich countries, you know, at the sort of most fundamental level, it's to do with the way the economies are organized. You know, a poor country like Egypt has extractive economic institutions, and a much more prosperous country like the United States has inclusive economic institutions. And that's economic institutions kind of rules, you know, by institutions, I just mean like rules that create patterns of incentives and opportunities. And inclusive economic institutions create broad-based patterns of incentives and opportunities. You know, they're inclusive. In Egypt, you know, there are incentives and opportunities, but they're for the few and not for the majority. But why that economy is organized like that, that is fundamentally political, you know. So there's the economics is important, but lying behind the economics is important. And Egypt has extractive economic institutions because it has extractive political institutions. Political power is concentrated narrowly, you know, in the hands of a military dictator. And, you know, so the Arab Spring is fascinating because it's also, you know, it's both about, you know, why is Egypt or Tunisia or, you know, or Syria poor, but also how could it become less poor? You know, how could institutions change from being extractive to inclusive? And that's about contestation, really. It's about the organization of the people who suffer under extractive institutions. And that's what the Arab Spring was all about. It was people suffering under extractive institutions who organized, who kind of pushed against it and tried to make a transition. But the Arab Spring is also fascinating because it shows you how difficult that is, you know, because if you look at Egypt today, yes, the Arab Spring removed one military dictator and now you have a different one in power, you know, and that's something we call the iron law of oligarchy, you know. So the book is both about, you know, why poor countries are like the way they are, how that's connected to the structure of their institutions, how you change those institutions, but why it's so difficult to change those institutions. And that's something that creates a lot of kind of inertia and persistence in the world.
Mm. And so if I look at it longitudinally, James, so it seems to me that the initial conditions matter a lot. So where you start matters a lot, right? Is that the right way to think about it?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly right. I mean, you know, early on in the book, we tell this story of the Americas, of divergence within the Americas. You know, the fascinating, you know, if you go back a few hundred years, the United States wasn't more prosperous than the rest of the Americas. But for historical reasons to do with, you know, how colonialism got organized in the New World, United States started with much more inclusive institutions than Latin American countries did, you know, and that created enormous, you know, differences in the possibilities in the 19th century. You know, when the Industrial Revolution started in England, it spread to the United States. It didn't spread to Latin America. Why? Because Latin America didn't have the same inclusive institutions that the United States did. And those those things persist, you know, those things persist today, like I was emphasizing, you know, a lot about this sort of the inertia of these institutions. I think, you know, if you want to understand the difference between North America and Latin America today, you do have to go back into the colonial period and understand how these societies got constructed in different ways and, you know, the different sort of possibilities and opportunities that that created for North America and Latin America. But, you know, in some sense, that is, it's a historical process, you know, and it's a somewhat idiosyncratic process also. You know, I don't think personally, and this is the argument in the book, there's no intrinsic reason why, you know, any part of the world is poor or any other part of the world is rich. That's to do with the way that people themselves create those societies, you know, and that's a function of power and incentives, but also historical contingency, as you say.
You also mentioned a lot of reversals. So, I mean, we'll go into the book, but Argentina, Soviet Union, I think you mentioned India. India had some help from England for the race to the bottom. But these reversals, are they sort of predictable based on the conditions that we see?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, like we sort of try to emphasize there that, you know, the sort of the big story historically is, you know, in the kind of creation of prosperity, like in Britain, you know, in the Industrial Revolution or in North America, is to do with the emergence of inclusive institutions, you know. But I think we also kind of want to emphasize that in any inclusive society, there's always incentives to create extractive institutions. You know, the leading example, you know, that we discuss a lot is Venice. You know, in the late Middle Ages, Venice might have been the most prosperous place in the world. You know, it had this enormous commercial empire all over the Mediterranean. You know, it was very innovative in many types of commercial contracts, institutions, in the financial sector, you know, but it all went into reverse because the inclusive institutions were basically overthrown by a political coup that created a far more extractive political system that then reversed the economic inclusion. You know, so I think, you know, so part of the point of those examples is to say, you know, like, you know, inclusive institutions are never guaranteed. You always have to try to fight for them and maintain them, that there's always incentives for people to put that into reverse. You know, I think looking at history is powerful from that perspective.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about this, James, later. So anything could sort of go back. So you cannot take anything for granted in any system. It just takes a few people or one person or a group of people. And so in the first chapter here, you say Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Sonora, have the same people, culture, and geography. Why is one rich and one poor? So Sonora is in Mexico, Arizona is in the US, and it is an area that is just divided. Is it divided by a river, these two areas?
No, it's just a fence, basically. Yeah.
Just a fence, okay. So why is one rich and one poor?
Well, because the one Nogales on the U.S. side of the border has far more inclusive institutions than Nogales on the Mexican side of the border. I mean, we like that example. We find that example very sort of visceral, you know, because, you know, it's what I would call a natural experiment that it's not an experiment the way that, you know, one would do in the natural sciences. But there's sort of experimental like variation in institutions in the sense that many other things are held constant. You know, geography is held constant, culture is held constant. That can't be what creates this difference. You know, it's the institutional differences that, you know, that are significant. We also use this example of like North and South Korea also.
Yeah.
Which is very kind of powerful, I think. So it's these institutional differences and the very different patterns of incentives and opportunities they create that makes Nogales in the United States so much more prosperous than Nogales in Mexico.
So North and South Korea, Nogales, Arizona, Nogales, Sonora. So you're rejecting the hypothesis, and this is one of the hypotheses, that prosperity is driven by people, culture, and geography. The geographical characteristics, it could be weather, it could be a lot of other things. And you're citing examples here that shows these things are pretty close together. They're the same people. same culture, but we see a distinct economic difference between them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I this is not a story of good guy or bad guy, or, you know, we use this example of, you know, Carlos Slim and Bill Gates, who were the two richest people in the world at the time we wrote the book. And, you know, they're both, you know, very brilliant, driven, you know, entrepreneurs, but, and they were the two richest men in the world. But what's fascinating is the very different way that they made their money. You know, Bill Gates made his money through innovation. Carlos Slim made his money through monopolies. And they're just responding to the very different institutional environment in
Mexico. Could argue Bill Gates also made his money through monopolies.
Of course, but yeah, that's part of the story. But that shows that Bill Gates isn't, it's not because he's a good guy. You know, if he could get away with being a monopolist, he'd do it. You know, it's just more difficult to do it in the United States. You know, Microsoft was found guilty of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act. Like, they have great antitrust laws in Mexico, but you'd never be able to enforce them on Carlos Slim, you know. So I think that's a key aspect of sort of showing that, you know, humans are the same everywhere, but you put them in different institutional environments, you know, they're going to behave in different ways, which have enormous consequences for the societies they're living in.
Yeah, so let me take a quick detour here, James. So we have contemporary antitrust litigation going on. There's a large search company that we have, and they have tens of thousands of lawyers. They have been able to kick the ball down the road, or whatever the right term is. Now it is, the case is not going to be taken up to like 2026 or something. And so are we coming to a position that, I mean, I understand your point, but even in the US, if you have tens of thousands of lawyers, you can get around this stuff pretty easily, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a live question as to whether what happened to Bill Gates, you know, 25 years ago, whatever it was, could actually happen now. You know, I think, you know, one thing we've seen in the United States, I think, is that institutions are becoming much less inclusive in many ways. You know, social mobility has fallen. There's been enormous increase in inequality. You know, if you look at innovators, for example, like one thing we discuss in the book, you know, is if you look historically at innovators in the United States, they come from enormously diverse social background. So that's not true anymore now. You know, people who come from wealthy households are many more times likely to innovate than people who come from poor households. So I think you see many aspects of inclusion in the United States have been going into the reverse in the last 30 or 40 years. And I think, you know, that what you're describing is how that's spilling over, you know, into the ineffectiveness of the institutions that in the past were very important for sustaining inclusion. So I completely agree with that. Yes. I think that's one of the big concerns that we have today in the United States.
Yeah, so we have to talk a little bit about that later. So in the second chapter here, James, you say poor countries are poor, not because of the geographies or cultures, and we talked about a couple of examples of this, or because the leaders do not know which policies will enrich their citizens. So this is the alternative hypothesis, that you have incompetent leaders who are making bad policies, right? So what is the evidence that we have against that?
Against
bad leaders making. Well,
I think there's always bad leaders and there's always good leaders. You know, I mean, I think what we know on average is that, you know, I mean, there's some very interesting research on this topic of the impact of leaders. You know, about whether or not when leaders die in office. You know, so let's just say, For some reason, you have a heart attack or whatever, the leader dies and you get a new leader. So do you see any significant change, say, in public policy or economic performance? And the answer is, yes, you do see significant change. But on average, it's not any better for economic performance. You know, things can get better, things can get worse. You get good leaders, you get bad leaders. But on average, there's no real impact, you know. So I think, you know, I think, you know, good leadership is great if you can get it. I think, you know, bad leadership is very common also. And I think, you know, what the evidence suggests is that it's very difficult to explain systematic patterns of economic development by the character of of leaders, you know. And to the extent that's true, you know, I think, you know, we think we would tend to think that it's because, you know, some types of institutions, like maybe democratic institutions, are better at selecting good leaders, although, you know, you can probably think of counterexamples to that too. Yeah.
Yeah, so when I think about leaders, you know, I think about Angela Merkel, I think about Jacinda Ardern, and I look at some of the other examples that we have around the world. They are dramatically opposite personalities, characteristics, ideas, ideologies. But what you're arguing is that the system matters, not the individual, right?
I think individuals do matter. I mean, I think individuals do matter. That I think it would be silly to argue that. You know, what I'm saying is that, you know, you can't explain why the United States, you know, has become so successful over the past 200 years relative to Latin America, say, by just saying, oh, the United States had a bunch of really good leaders and Latin America didn't. You know, I think that's the, you know, that's what I'm saying. You know, the leaders surely matter. But, you know, if you think about these systematic patterns, that's not about leadership. It's about the underlying institutions.
So leaders are, I mean, this is new insight for me, James. So leaders are, in some sense, if I understand this correctly, it's a second order effect. If you don't have the right system, if you don't have free markets, free trade, liberty, you know, general concepts of these things, then you could have a great leader, but that leader is going to take tens or many decades before he can turn the country around. It's like a big ship that he or she is trying to drive.
Yes, or you can't sustain, you know, the benefits, that any benefits you create. You know, to sustain things, you have to institutionalize things. You know, you can have transitory successes, but you can't consolidate that, I guess I would say. You know, I mean, I think, like, think about Deng Xiaoping. You know, for me, you know, Deng Xiaoping was a sort of remarkable person. You know, it's difficult to argue that he was not important, you know, in the turnaround in Chinese economic development from the late 1970s. But he failed to institutionalize, you know, the system that he tried to create. You know, he tried to create term limits, for example, and that's fallen apart now in China. President Xi got rid of all, you know, and is now consolidating personal political power in a way that Deng Xiaoping tried to stop, you know.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk a little bit, take a detour there, James. So China's a good contemporary example. It has been exceptionally successful. As I mentioned, I grew up in India in 1960s. GDP per capita, China and India was about $2,000. China's now 10x that. India's maybe 3,000, 3,500. So India has progressed incrementally. It's about the same number of people in both of these countries, but China has a tremendous, tremendous growth. And so how do you attribute that to? Is that leadership or is that system?
I think, you know, I mean, I think that's, you know, we don't talk much about India in Why Nations Fail. We talk much more about it in the sequel, The Narrow Corridor. You know, I'd say a few things about that. I'd say one is, you know, in the Chinese case, the theory we have kind of seems to fit very well in some dimensions and not very well in other dimensions. And let me explain that, you know. It's clear that the transition, the economic transition that took place in China, you know, from the late 1970s is sort of exactly a movement from extractive to much more inclusive institutions. You know, the Communist Party dismantled communism. It created incentives in agriculture, you know, to start with this household responsibility system. It let people make decisions. It made them the residual claimants on their efforts. There was a huge increase in productivity. You know, this sort of spreads to, you know, the manufacturing and industry in the 1980s. So the economic transition is exactly moving towards more inclusive institutions. Like, what doesn't fit is that the politics are still very extractive. You know, the politics are still controlled by the Communist Party, you know, whereas our theory is about, you know, you have to, if you want to have a really inclusive economy, That has to be underpinned by inclusive political institutions, and you don't have that in China. So what do I say about that? I say that's a transitory situation. China doesn't have the political model to become a really successful economy. You know, like you mentioned the Soviet Union and Argentina earlier on. You know, those are two fantastic examples. You know, like the Soviet Union grew extremely rapidly for about 50 years from the mid-1920s, you know, when they set up this kind of central planning operation. It grew very rapidly. You know, when I was a student in England 40 years ago, you know, we learned that if you wanted to be successful economically, you had to have Soviet style, you know, central planning. I mean, that sounds completely crazy to everybody now. Everyone's forgotten that the Soviet Union was thought of as an economic miracle. You know, of course, there's many differences between China and the Soviet Union, but I think it should lead everyone to pause for a minute to when they think about how everyone was fooled by, you know, 30 or 40 years of rapid economic growth in the Soviet Union. You know, like it was a sort of chimera. You know, so of course, there's many differences, you know, with the Chinese experience, but you know, the Soviet experience was transitory, and I would say, you know, we would say, you can't have an inclusive economy at the whim of a dictatorship, you know, and so it will collapse. I don't know how it will collapse or when it will collapse, but what history suggests is, you know, in the same way that nobody predicted that the Soviet Union would collapse or how the Soviet Union would collapse, but it did collapse. And I think the same will happen with China, you know. So I think that's, you know, that's what I say about China. I think the Indian case is sort of fascinating, you know, because but when we wrote Why Nations Fail, it was sort of outside the scope of our kind of scholarship, you know. So we've been trying, you know, much, you know, obviously, like at some level, political institutions in India are much more inclusive. You know, it's a very vibrant democracy, but inclusive political institutions from our perspective, you know, there's two parts of that. You know, one is this element of kind of participation and broad-based political power, but the state, the capacity and the effectiveness of the state is very important. I mean, what China has is a centralized state that's much better at getting things done than in India. You know, I think the problem in India is that the state lacks capacity. I think also, you know, India, and this is something which, you know, is kind of a bit outside of our theory, you know, at some sociological level, there's big problems of inclusion in India. You know, if you think about like this whole caste system, you know, caste system is enormous, like is enormously anti-inclusive, if you like. I mean, that's a kind of sociological thing, you know, which is almost outside of our theory, as I say. But I think if you look at Indian society, you can see, you know, the state is very bad at kind of providing key public goods, but there's also other elements of extractive institutions that make it very difficult to have social mobility of the sort that's kind of really required. You know, look at what happens when you take Indians out of India and put in other institutional environments. They're unbelievably successful.
Well, there's a biased sample problem there.
There's selection, of course. There's selection, of course. But I do think that's, you know, that of course there's selection. But I, you know, so that's what I would say about India. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to throw a wrench into this, James. Just peripherally. So I grew up in the southern state of India called Kerala. When India got independent in 1947, the first government that they elected was a Marxist government. They call it a Marxist government. And since then, it has been off and on. You know, they come in for 5 years and somebody else comes in for 5 years and they come back for 5 years. They're not quite Marxists. They are sort of, in your terminology, I would think they're more inclusive. Mm-hmm. I mean, this might be a research topic. I haven't really studied the data, but the state is quite successful, actually. You know, 100% literacy, very good healthcare, about 2x GDP per capita compared to the rest of the country. And so, I mean, it is sort of ambiguous, right? So I think, you know, I'm sort of gravitating to your thesis, which is, it is sort of inclusivity that ultimately makes things happen. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, of course, India is very heterogeneous. You know, there's many different regional cultures and regional histories and languages. And I think Kerala is fascinating, you know, because, you know, you could go back even, I mean, the standard sort of story, you know, that the Amartya Sen or whatever would tell would go, you know, much further back in history and start talking about this Travancore. Is it this pre-colonial polity? And, you know, and, yeah. And you know, like there are sort of deep roots for how Kerala, kind of a very different type of society emerged in Kerala, you know. And some people also emphasized, you know, this aspect of like, you know, matrilineal inheritance and even kind of, you know, like a sort of, again, like more sociological, you know, women's empowerment, for example, also tends to be, you know, very different in Kerala than other parts of India. And so, you know, so I think it's an interesting example just to show there's very big differences. I mean, India is such a heterogeneous place, you know.
Yeah, it's a very complex story. So if you do a multifactorial regression, there's too many factors to control for. So in chapter three, you say how prosperity and poverty are determined by the incentives created by institutions and how politics determines what institutions a nation has. So ultimately, for people to do better things, they need to have incentives, right? I mean, that's sort of the fundamental idea here, right? So if somebody takes over a country and say, you know, you go work in the field and then you pay 99% taxes, that person any incentive to do anything, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's not our idea. You know, economic theory is all about incentives. And, you know, so I tend not to dwell on that part because I find like every economist knows that, you know, but what they don't know is like, you know, if it's so great to have incentives, you know, and if incentives come from institutions, which I think we know as well, you know, you mentioned markets, you know, what are markets? Markets an institution, it creates incentives, you know, to allocate resources efficiently, you know, for people to move to jobs where their talents are like most productively used, you know, like that's an institution. But then the question, you know, becomes, well, if it's so great to have these institutions, like why doesn't everybody have them? You know, why don't they create them in Haiti? Or why don't they create them in Nigeria? Or like what, you know, like what's that? And that's where the politics comes in. And I think that's the real contribution of the book, you know, relative to what Milton Friedman knew, for example.
Yeah, so this goes into in chapter four, you say how institutions change through political conflict and how the past shapes the present. So we talked a bit about this. So I want to get your perspective on this. So it seems to me, without knowing anything about this, James, it seems to me that initial conditions matter a lot. So where you start sort of gets you where you're going to end in some ways, unless something dramatic changes, right? Is that true?
I think that's true. Yeah, there's enormous persistence in the world. You know, I think, you know, we there's persistence of inclusive institutions, but there's also persistence in extractive institutions, you know, and this takes us back to the Arab Spring. You know, it's just sort of a moment where very deeply seated extractive institutions were sort of challenged, but they more or less emerged unscathed everywhere, you know. So I think that's one of the generalizations we have in the book is to sort, you know, once you see that, you know, and you see in Latin America, you know, there have been countless revolutions in Latin America or attempts to kind of fight against extractive institutions, but extractive institutions often get recreated, you know. So that's just to say, these initial conditions you're talking about, they're enormously important in, you know, once a society gets set off in a particular direction, then there's enormous inertia in that, you know. And you know, if you think about this example of the Americas, you know, we know these big differences in prosperity in the Americas today. You know, if you went back 50 years, that would be extremely similar. If you went back 100 years, it would be extremely similar. If you went back 100, you know, so that these patterns of, you know, the United States and Canada, then maybe Argentina, Chile, and Central America at the bottom, that's been enormously persistent like that for a long time. Okay, if you went back 500 years, of course, it wouldn't be there. You know, in fact, you'd find something completely different before colonization came. You know, if anything, prosperity and kind of the development of civilization was much more advanced in Mexico, you know, and Central America, Andean South America than it was anywhere in North America. So, you know, if you go back far enough in history, you see actually there's been an enormous sort of reversal. And that reversal was created by European colonialism and European settlement and how that created very different types of societies in different parts of the Americas. So, you know, I guess my, you know, when Professor Acemoglu and I, you know, when we first started working on these topics kind of 30 years ago, you know, a lot of the discussion was dominated by these very simplistic kind of accounts of like Professor Sachs, you know, Jeffrey Sachs, you know, who was sort of promoting the idea that countries that were in the tropics were intrinsically poor compared to, you know, countries that were in temperate latitudes, you know, and I think that's completely wrong, you know, like it's just wrong, you know, it's just really the way the world looks today, there's nothing sort of, you know, there's nothing definitive, there's no definitive connection, you know, to geography or ecology or anything like that. It's just a kind of layered history of human innovation and settlement and creation and you know, but what happens in the past has these enormous, you know, inertial consequences, you know, as you're, and these initial conditions are very important. And once they get going, you know, it's very hard to perturb, you know. If you think about China, you know, one of the things we point out in the narrow corridor where we sort of talk much more about the deeper kind of historical dynamics of China, again, you know, if you went back in history, you know, you see many things in China that were similar to the history of Western Europe in terms of like parliament and representation and kind of the involvement of people in politics. And but then once you get the creation of this first dynasty, you know, about 200 BC in China, then you get into this kind of path which sort of reinforces itself, you know, of the dominance of the state over society, of extractive institutions, a whole ideology that comes around it. You know, that's not something we deal with too much in Why Nations Fail, because, you know, we're economists, so it's difficult to deal with ideology. But it's obvious in the Chinese case that, you know, or even in the Indian case, you know, like we were talking about the caste system. Well, the caste system is, you know, fits into these kind of religious beliefs also, you know. So it's not just an economic institution, though. It's deeply embedded in the culture. And that's the same thing in China. So that's, we're doing a lot of research on that at the moment. But, you know, culture is very badly studied by economists, as you're probably aware. So.
So, I mean, there's some tactical, I don't know if the right term, tactical perturbations here, James. So I don't know the exact numbers, but something like 3/4 of GDP of the US are created by first generation immigrants. So they reached the country 1960s onward. We have one of the greatest presidents just waiting to return, want to shut down immigration. So what do you think that will do to the US?
Oh, I think it would be a disaster. You know, I think like one of the reasons why the United States has been so dynamic, you know, over the past 200 years is it created, you know, it became a magnet to suck talent from all over the world, you know, and I think that's one of the major things it actually has in its favor, you know, and if it shuts that down, you know, then it's a disaster for the future of innovation and economic growth in the United States. But, you know, that's the story of extractive institutions. You know, extractive institutions are for some people's benefit, but at the expense of social welfare, you know. So just as Venice shut itself down, you know, of course, the United States could shut itself down, too. And I think like what we've learned, you know, in the past, you know, 5-6, you know, years or more, is that there's far less commitment in the United States to inclusive institutions than anyone imagined. That we have, you know, I certainly didn't imagine, you know, when we wrote that book, you know, with the book, we're often criticized for being very optimistic about the United States. And I think that's because, you know, I work a lot in developing countries. You know, I worked for for 30 years in Colombia, you know, all over sub-Saharan Africa. I just came back from, you know, working in Nigeria a week ago. And when you've been in Nigeria for a few weeks or Colombia and you come to the United States, you know, you appreciate
You can see the contrast. You can see the status quo contrast.
You see all the things that work in this country. And so it's very difficult for me to be pessimistic about the United States. But there are these things going on that you just identified that are kind of, I find, like, frightening, honestly, as an economist, yeah, or as a citizen.
Yes. So in chapter five, you say here, what Stalin, Kim Shyam, and Neolithic Revolution and the Maya city states all had in common, and how this explains why China's current economic growth cannot last. So this is a pretty difficult hypothesis, in the sense that we have very little data on this, right? I'll just throw it out to you, let you react to it. Yeah,
we try, I think we're social scientists. So, what you do in social sciences, you develop a sort of simple theory and then you try to push it as far as possible. So I think the examples you're talking about is, we're taking our theory and we're trying to push it as far as possible. So the Maya, the Maya city state, the Maya collapse is a sort of fantastic example where, talking about how prosperous Central America was, five, and this is 1,000 years ago, you have this blooming in Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, of these Maya societies. They were very innovative in terms of institutions, building public goods, roads, cisterns, whatever, but they collapsed, it all went into decline, the civilizations went into decline, and the cities depopulated and were abandoned, by the time the Spaniards got to that part of Latin America, that they were all overgrown. These places were, the splendor of these Maya cities was only discovered, starting in the 19th century, really. So we just try to take what we know, what archaeologists know or historians know about how Maya society was organized and what might have caused this kind of reversal, to say, here's how we'd apply our ideas to think about these kind of reversals in Maya society. Could we explain the collapse of the Maya city-states as a kind of transition from something which was more inclusive to less, inclusive or more extractive? But those examples, as you say, the evidence is limited, so there's going to be an element of kind of speculation, to say the least, but that's social science is like that. We're on much firmer ground in more contemporary situations, obviously, where the data is better and we know a lot more.
I mean, technically it's an optimization problem. So, I am very fond of the Chicago School ideas. If you have the right incentives, you put the people together into a system, they will all do, what they could do, and the system will improve. But if you have, as you say, extractive elements in there, then your incentives are going to decline. And, it all depends on where you start from, but generally, it declines, the status of society, right? So, I want to get your perspective on, I don't know if this is in the research, James. So if you look at Scandinavia, for instance, it's a small country, it's less than 10 million people, or New Zealand, or something like that. They all seem to be doing pretty well. The happiness in the index, for instance, all come out pretty good. I don't know the GDP growth, but I haven't looked at GDP per capita growth or anything like that. So is GDP per capita growth a really interesting metric for society in the future?
I mean, I think so. I think the problem with, using GDP as a metric is, it's not taking into account, for example, the use of environmental resources or the degradation of the environment. That's not priced into.
It's an external cost that's not accounted for. Yeah,
exactly. So there is, there is very innovative work, trying to come up with these new versions of national accounts that take that sort of thing into account. Partha Dasgupta, who's a professor, a professor at the University of Cambridge in England, did kind of path-breaking work on this. It hasn't really caught on. There's a very developed academic literature on this, but you don't see countries really announcing these numbers. which is So, which is, you know, it would be a step. It would be a step if they did that, you know, because it would make people much more conscious, you know, of the consequences of what's going on. I think you're right that, you know, that there's from that perspective, you know, there's a problem with looking at GDP per capita. I just think that, you know, if we think about, you know, the world over the past couple of hundred years, you know, the trajectory of GDP per capita actually is pretty informative about which countries have been successful, you know, at improving the living standards and the opportunities and the life chances of their people, and which countries have not been successful. You know, if I look at the GDP per capita of the United States or Haiti or Colombia, or, you know, that's pretty informative of, you know, what it's like to be in those countries.
Yeah, it's a really complex thing. So, you know, so reading through your book, I got quite depressed, James. So, you know, so if you rewind time back 500,000 years, Homo sapiens, I would argue, continue to have a two-factor objective function. Food, recently replaced by wealth and money, and sex, which is basically a biological programmatic need to spread your genes. And I don't think Homo sapiens have changed at all in the modern context. So if you have a two-factor objective function, what you're going to get is what we see, I think. Do you disagree?
Well, I think, you know, I think Homo sapiens has created these enormously elaborate societies, you know, very, very rapidly. You know, if you thought about the span of, like, you know, evolutionary history, this has all happened at the kind of bat of an eyelid in some sense. And I think part of the problem is it's happening so fast and in such a complex way that we don't really understand it. You know, we don't understand the consequences of things we're doing. You know, do we really understand the consequences of, like, everybody having these cell phones and, like, you know, like, I mean, it's just, you know, or, like, think about this artificial intelligence. You know, it's so prone to unintended consequences, you know. And I think somehow, you know, for a couple of thousand years, you know, maybe 10,000 years maximum, we, you know, since the Neolithic Revolution, which you mentioned earlier, where you get this transition, you know, in human society towards agriculture and kind of the development of urban life and society and specialization. And, you know, there's a sort of phase transition takes place, you know. But of course, that's nothing compared to these millions of years of human evolution. So I think, like, somehow we've kept it on the rails, you know, not always, you know. Think about, you know, fascism and warfare, and, you know, so human society is prone to go off, you know, on devastating tangents, you know, and to develop kind of collective projects which are disastrous. And somehow we've kept it on the rails, you know, for 10,000 years. But I don't think there's anything inevitable about that. As you're saying, like, we're sort of driven by fundamental things, you know, but we can create these enormously elaborate societies on top of that, you know. And it's not clear whether they're advantageous ultimately for kind of pushing our objectives, or in contradiction, you know, like many people would think, you know, we're in the process of completely destroying the planet we're living on, you know. And, you know, so there, ultimately, you know, we're destroying the ecosystem that has allowed us to flourish for millions of years, you know. And I'm not sure I'm enough of a scientist, you know, a relevant scientist to have a view on that, but it's clearly a possibility. I mean, when I talk to my colleagues here at the university who know much more about this, you know, this is a possibility that they take very seriously. Yeah,
I don't know much about this, James. So I'm going to chapter 7. So I want to understand this. So how political revolution in 1688 changed institutions in England and then to the Industrial Revolution. So this is quite a fundamental point of the book, right? You know, you generally argue the systems matter, incentives matter, how we set it up, how hierarchical, how extractive the economy is, matters. So what happened in 1688 in England?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's a revolution. You know, that was a transition from, it was the emergence of constitutional monarchy. You know, it was the defeat of an attempt to create an absolutist monarchy. And it created a far more inclusive political system in Britain. You know, and it, you know, it was like the rise of parliamentary sovereignty and constitutional rule. And then it led, you know, we argue, to much more inclusive economic institutions. So that's, you know, of course, why, you know, why focus on Britain? Well, because, you know, we know that the Industrial Revolution happened in Britain, and the Industrial Revolution happens, you know, about, starts about 50, 60 years after the Glorious Revolution. You know, we're arguing that's not a coincidence. It's the, this political transition that lays the ground for more inclusive economic institutions that then lays the ground for the Industrial Revolution. You know, so that's a momentous transition in the modern world. And, you know, we want to explain that by this transition from extractive to inclusive institutions in Britain.
And so what you're arguing here is an Industrial Revolution, which had a huge impact on humans' lives, the utility of humans all around the world, really started by sort of an institutional change in England in the late 1688, you say here.
Yeah, but it created a very different institutional environment. You know, I think if you look, for example, at innovation, you know, here, unlike with the Maya city-states, we have much better data. You know, what you see is, you know, following the Glorious Revolution, you see this enormous surge in patenting, for example, in Britain, you know, which is a very good marker of innovation. You know, people were patenting, people were innovating, they were taking out patents on their innovations. And, you know, I think you see many of these technologies, you know, which are so associated with the Industrial Revolution and the modern world, you know, the development of the steam engine, for example, and mechanization of production, you know, the factory system, you know, many things that we just take for granted now, we can't imagine they didn't exist, you know, but and railways, you know, like transportation technology, you know, all of this stuff comes, steel ships, you know, whatever. And then there's, you know, of course, this is all followed by electricity and, you know, many other kind of inventions and innovations. And but it's sort of the Industrial Revolution that gets this thing going, you know, and it's almost like the systemization of innovation, too. You know, innovation becomes much more professionalized, you know, it becomes much more institutionalized, you know, it becomes like not a kind of one-off thing like Isaac Newton with the apple falling on his head and inventing gravity. It becomes something like, yeah, we understand this. We put resources into it. You know, we invest in it. We work with science. You know, we, it becomes like something systematic in the way that it never had done before. You know, that's absolutely critical, you know, to thinking about the last 250 years also.
Yeah, so if I understand this correctly, James, so what you're arguing is that the two-factor objective function remains unless you have returns to innovation, patenting, intellectual property accruing to the inventor. The inventor is not going to do it. I mean, it's a pretty simple equation, right? It's all about utility.
Yeah, I mean, you know, our view of the world, you know, which is pretty simple, at least in my experience, you know, working in different parts of the world, is that, you know, people in the Congo, you know, they want exactly what you and I have. You know, they want access to, you know, to opportunities, to schools, to good healthcare, you know, to universities, to, you know, they want to travel, they want, you know, but what, why don't they? You know, because they don't have the opportunities. They don't have
constraints. Because,
you know, so I think, like, our view of humans is sort of like, you know, I mean, after all, we go back and, you know, you go back 50,000 years or 60,000 years, you know, most humans are related to a bunch of people who kind of moved out of Africa, you know, who came from East Africa and then spread around the world, you know. So I think, like, our view, you know, we're not saying here there are big differences in people, you know, at some kind of fundamental genetic or human level. But you put humans in very different incentive environments and they're going to behave in very different ways, you know. So And I think, like, you know, in some sense, you know, there's, you know, but, you know, what distinguishes humans also, though, you know, is this sort of creativity. You know, I guess, you know, some people would say this is to do with the brain, our brains, you know, like, you know, what you look historically, you know, for example, human brains, you know, become bigger. And, you know, if you look at the physiology of Homo sapiens compared to Neanderthals, you know, you see these changes. You know, yeah. We've had language, you know, language allows us to communicate and discuss. And, you know, like, why is it that most famous philosophical works, you know, are dialogues? You know, Plato's Republic is a dialogue, you know, because we talk to each other, we argue, we learn, we reason, you know, so I think that innovativeness of humans is something sort of, you know, something remarkable, you know, I mean, that, you know, and that comes from, of course, these very slow moving, you know, maybe physiological, sociological, or cultural changes. And that what's kind of explodes, you know, in the last 200, 250 years in ways, you know, that people couldn't really, you know, predict or kind of contain. You know, I think there's something, yeah, I always think, like, you know, here's an example I use, you know, when I teach, which is, you know, there's 9,000 species of ants, right? So ants, you know, when ants came to Canada, Canada's cold, it's kind of barren, there's all these, you know, like, ants speciated, you know, so that a new type of ant emerged that was better adapted to Canada. But when Homo sapiens never speciated, you know, when we got to Canada, what did we do? We invented igloos, you know, and we developed the taste, and ice fishing, and we developed a taste for seal blubber, you know, like, humans adapt and they innovate and they can create different societies and different parts, you know, like, that's, I think that's something about humans. It's just sort of remarkable. We're remarkably kind of innovative and creative.
Yeah, humans also have a selection advantage in the sense that, I mean, you talk about this in the book, the Spanish and the Portuguese went to South America and Central America, colonize that first. So temperature, closeness to equator mattered in terms of how to do it. And then by the time the English came, there's only North America left. It's sort of barren. And so, yeah, I mean, I think humans can, in some sense, we have more flexibility than ants, I would argue, right? Is that true?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not a biologist, you know, or I'm not, you know, but I think that's clear, like, how I would want to describe that fundamentally, you know, I think obviously we have these much bigger brains, you know, and that gives us enormous kind of capabilities that ants don't have, you know, to create and innovate and, you know, and I mean, I think this example you're talking about, the Americas, yeah, it's true that, you know, of course, people were very interested in, you know, sugarcane or tobacco or, you know, these sort of tropical crops. And so the tropics looked like places where, you know, there was just much more money to be made, you know, if we go back 400 or 500 years. But I guess for us, the important thing is not sugarcane or whatever, but the type of societies that led to, you know, the type of society based on slavery or, you know, very hierarchical extractive institutions. That's what's significant in the long run, how those initial conditions led to very different types of societies.
I'm thinking, James, that if the greatest president ever gets back to the White House in the US, I'm going to go buy an island and I'm going to make it free for any technologists to come in and innovate. And I think I can make that island a very interesting country.
Yeah, I think there's all sorts of schemes like that. I was reading in the newspaper about this scheme in Northern California. Now, haven't all these like tech people bought all this land and they want to create this city like somewhere near the Napa Valley? Is it? Am I can't remember the name of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's happening. I mean, for a while it was New Zealand. A lot of people were actually leaving the U.S. to go to New Zealand. I think stuff like that is going to happen. I think, yeah, I mean, U.S., I would argue U.S. is at great risk of losing everything that it has built up last 900 years, let's say.
Well, you know, if you think about it, like this modern nation state, you know, is a very recent creation. You know, if you went back and looked historically at Europe, you know, you find city states, the Hanseatic League, you know, you find an enormous proliferation of different types of political institutions. It's only in the 19th century, you know, that Germany emerges or Italy emerges out of something much more decentralized and heterogeneous. So why couldn't that be recreated? Yeah, I think, you know, again, I think looking at history is a good, it's salutary, right? Because you see, you know, we are innovative and we can come up with different ways of doing things. And why not? You know, you have to change and adapt when the world changes, you know.
Yeah, so I just, so in chapter 9, you say how European colonialism impoverished large parts of the world. So this is a larger topic. So what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I, you know, again, colonialism was very heterogeneous. You know, the United States was created by European colonialism. You know, so was Australia and New Zealand. And, you know, so these are, you know, these were, you know, these were, you know, that. But typically, you know, the story that, that we have, the argument we make is that, you know, Europeans were interested in, you know, creating extractive institutions wherever they could. And they did that in Latin America or large parts of Africa or India, you know, that that's what they did, or the Middle East. But, you know, why didn't they do that in the United States or Australia? Well, they did. They tried to, but basically there was no one to exploit, you know. So they try. If you look at the early, you know, we tell the story of the early history of the United States, of the, you know, the Virginia, the Jamestown colony. I mean, what's interesting about that is that they absolutely had this model of like creating extractive institutions. It just didn't work. You know, it didn't work in Virginia. And so then there was this period of experimentation of like, okay, that's not going to work. How do we do, what do we do? Like this kind of experimenting with different models, you know. And then that's when they came up with a far more inclusive way of organizing institutions, you know. So I think, so colonialism had these, you know, heterogeneous effects, I would say, you know, if I was being more nerdy, you know. But while it was creating the United States and Australia and New Zealand, of course, it was, you know, it was immiserating huge, you know, other parts of the world, expropriating land, you know, enslaving people, you know, taking natural resources. You know, that's the story in Africa. It's the story in Latin America, you know, India, you know, large parts of South Asia.
Why did not work in Virginia, James? I couldn't quite understand it. I mean, compared to South America, what was different about Virginia?
Well, because, you know, there were very few indigenous people on the ground. So, you know, early Spanish colonization was basically, it was based on the exploitation of indigenous people. So they took over indigenous society and then used indigenous people, basically kind of enslaved indigenous people. I mean, it's not exactly the institution of slavery. The Spanish had other institutions. You know, and that was the model that the British had in mind when they came. But, you know, the eastern seaboard of the United States, indigenous people were very few on the ground. And they
It's empty. It's empty, basically. Yeah, it was practically empty. Yeah.
And then the Virginia Company realized that their model was to create this colonial society based on exploiting indigenous people, but it was actually impossible. Think of Australia. It's the same thing. You know, what you see in Australia, again, Aboriginal society, Aboriginal population was very thin on the ground. It was like focused much more on the center of the continent. And, you know, and it was impossible to explain. You know, also Aboriginal society was very decentralized. You know, it didn't have political structures. You know, if you look at the colonization of the Americas, that worked much better in places where there were already centralized indigenous societies, like the Central Valley of Mexico or in Peru, you know, in the Andean civilization, the Inca, you know. So then the Spanish could kind of take over these pre-existing hierarchies. You didn't have those hierarchies in Australia. You didn't have those hierarchies in the eastern seaboard of the United States. So that model didn't work. You know, it didn't work. And you couldn't grow sugarcane either. You know, you couldn't grow many of these tropical crops.
It's too cold. Just too cold.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah. But again, you know, the reason that's important is for explaining the type of institutions that that emerged, you know. And so that's that, you know, that history of the United States. And, you know, I'm talking very early on about Virginia and Jamestown. But what we show in the chapter is that gets repeated in Maryland. It gets repeated in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You know, there's these endless attempts which actually fail to create extractive institutions in the United States. and a very different type of society emerges. And actually, the same story happens in Australia. You know, we point out that in Australia, you know, when the colonization of Australia starts, it's a sort of penal colony run by the military, for heaven's sake. Mm-hmm. You know, it was completely extractive, but that society wasn't viable. You know, it wasn't viable, and then they start experimenting. You know, the soldiers wanted to make money. You know, and they had a monopoly of rum. So they thought, we can make money by selling rum to the convicts. But the convicts didn't have any money, so they couldn't afford to buy rum. So what do? Give the convicts some freedom. Let them give them some property. Let them, you know, let them have land. Let them start businesses. Let them, you know. So we tell these stories of like how these much more inclusive. I mean, Australia is a sort of remarkable place, you know, because it goes from being this penal colony to possibly the most, one of the most inclusive societies in the world in about 50 years. Yeah.
Yeah, this is great, James. So. In conclusion, I wondered if you could speculate a bit. So we are here in the US, and so we say this is the oldest democracy in the world. That's so to speak.
Counts, yeah. We could argue about that.
We have some very large democracies to the east, and we have elections coming up in all these places. And we see signs of, I would say, I mean, this is my bias, things going backward in many places. And so are we sort of witnessing sort of the first instances? I mean, we have seen, as you say, in Argentina, Soviet Union, and elsewhere, that things go really good for a while and then turn back. Are we seeing that type of a trend in these countries?
I think, we're certainly seeing a trend in that direction. You know, whether it's going to like destroy American institutions, we don't know yet. You know, I think, you know, President Trump basically has no commitment whatsoever to democracy. And, you know, many Republican politicians seem to have no commitment either, in the sense that, you know, they maintain that he was cheated out of power. And that's a complete lie. There's no evidence that, you know, he was cheated. He lost the election, but he maintains he won the election. You know, so for me, that shows those people have no commitment to democracy. And I think, you know, you have to think that were he to win the election, they would do everything they could to try to undermine the democratic process in this country. And I think there's only one way that is going to end up, you know, if it succeeds, you know. I mean, what we also saw in the last election is many people are willing to fight against that, you know, at the expense of their own interests. And, I think there were some remarkable heroics in that last election in terms of people doing their duty and like fighting for the institutions in terms of the vote. Yeah, so that's what we're reliant on. You know, I mean, I think that's where we are in this country. And, you know, I think one thing you could do if you looked at history was to say, it's not the first time institutions in this country have been challenged, you know, like, you know, Franklin, you know, FDR in the 1930s, after all, Roosevelt stayed in power. You know, he violated George Washington, you know, the first president, set this precedent that, you know, he basically said no president should be there for more than two terms. And everyone respected that until Roosevelt, you know, in the 1930s. And Roosevelt stayed in power, you know, way after he should have left. He tried to pack the Supreme Court. You know, he did all sorts of very naughty things, Roosevelt. Now, everyone's forgotten about that now. They just remember the good things. But I think he did things that Trump would be kind of unimaginable to Trump, you know. Like, so I think...
Pope is not reading history books because he'll get some ideas.
I don't think he reads books, Donald Trump. So I think there have been very bad presidents in the United States before, and the institutions have been challenged. Think about the Civil War, for heaven's sake. You know, what was that other than a kind of conflict over the institutions of the country? You know, that's a pretty scary thought, no?
I remember Angela Merkel saying, when I leave, I will leave with no drama. And, that's what leaders do. So what are your thoughts on India? How it's sort of shaping up? I mean, we talk about the caste system. There is an underlying religious thing going on here. So what are your thoughts on that in contemporary?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think what the evidence shows is that, you know, many different religious systems are consistent with having an inclusive economy. You know, I was like, when I teach, I always use the example of Japan. You know, look at Japan. You know, Japanese religion looks nothing like Western religion, Shintoism, and, you know, the whole notion of deity and like one's relationship with God, and, you know, and you know, how you, you know, what a good life looks like. I mean, it's completely different from Western ideas of religion. And, you know, so I feel there's many, you know, think about the United Arab Emirates, you know, whatever. Like, that's a very Muslim country. It's a very Islamic society. They've made huge strides economically in the past 30 or 40 years, you know. So I don't see religion as being, I think there's a lot of freedom for people to practice religion and you know, in their own way, and you know, and I think what you saw in India, you know, in the 90s, and you know, you saw a transition towards more inclusive institutions, a kind of opening of the economy, you know, the dismantling of many of like what economists called, used to call the license Raj in India. And what you saw a pickup in economic growth, you know, you saw a lot of economic dynamism in India. I mean, I think that, you know, the fact of the matter is there's still lots of institutional problems in India, and that's why, you know, it hasn't done what China has done. But and, you know, as I met, I do think obviously the caste system is related to, but, you know, religion can be interpreted and reinterpreted, and you know, I'm pretty sure Indians can find a model of growth which is sort of consistent with their cultural values, but also creates the kind of economic inclusion that, you know, that we know is necessary for innovation and rapid economic growth.
Excellent. James, thanks so much for spending time with me.
Okay, my pleasure. Yeah, it's been fun. Yes, okay.